Modern Oil Corporation against Barbara Candy, Mark H. Smith, the accountant, Alexander A. Dairy, the accountant, Nancy A. Daniel, Jackie Michael, the accountant.
Good morning.
Wait just one moment until your opposing counsel gets set. All right, you now may proceed.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court. I'm Mark Schmidt on behalf of the appellant, Modern Oil Corporation. The facts in this case below involved a sale of stock of the appellant, Modern Oil. And in conjunction with that sale of stock, there was a promise made to the employees that if they were still employed by the company within 90 days after the closing, they'd receive a bonus, or if they were terminated by cause by the company within 90 days of the closing, they would still receive a bonus. The bonus was approximately a month's wages. Now, there was no promise to pay a bonus if they were terminated with cause, and there was no promise to pay a bonus to them if they left. The stock sale closed. Bonuses were paid to some employees, but not to the 10 plaintiffs below. And the logic was these 10 plaintiffs had accepted employment with new operators of convenience stores, and therefore they were not entitled to the bonus. A lawsuit ensued, and in the case below, the letter promising the bonuses was a letter written by the president of the company on October 24th, approximately 44 days before the sale of the stock.
Counsel, may I interrupt you there?
Yes.
In your complaint, the fraud allegation is an actual misrepresentation allegation as opposed to a non-disclosure allegation.
In the plaintiff's complaint.
Plaintiff's complaint, yes. When you were at trial, you objected at motion to strike both to the lack of pleading on the constructive fraud and non-disclosure, as well as the concession made by the plaintiff about the lack of any actual fraud associated with the letter. Was it clear what the trial court's ruling was on the lack of pleading, the unpled non-disclosure point?
I don't believe it was.
Okay. So there really is no discussion, apparently, at least from the bench or in the final order, specifically on that issue.
Of the lack of a adequate pleading to substantiate the claim?
Right.
No, that wasn't the thrust of most of the discussions that occurred.
Okay, just wanted to check. Thank you.
However, that would be a basis for ruling in the defendant's favor.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that first question. I'm sure we'll hear from the plaintiff's counsel in a minute.
As you noted, there was a concession that by the plaintiffs at the trial that there was no fraud associated with the October 24th letter. There was no evidence of any kind of fraudulent intent by Elliott Whitfield or Modern Oil in connection with that letter. And 44 days passed, and at the December 7th closing, following the closing, the new operators took over. There was no gap in pay for the employees, and the employees stipulated a trial that they had been offered and had accepted employment within 90 days of the closing by the new operators, or by some of them. Now, at trial, the plaintiffs argued that Modern Oil had made a fraudulent admission on this December 7th closing date because they didn't affirmatively come forward and tell these 10 employees they weren't going to be paying them a bonus. Now, the Supreme Court case law says that fraud is evaluated at the time a promise is made. And again, of course, that's back on October 24th, and there's no argument, it was conceded, that there was no fraudulent intent at the time this promise was made. And as far as I know, there's no duty to clarify a promise after it's made. There's no cases where there wasn't a clarification made later that relates back to that first date. You just look at the date.
What about when it's a unilateral contract that can only be accepted by someone acting?
Well, the case law doesn't say you evaluate the fraud at the time the contract's accepted. The case law, in all the cases that I came across, said you evaluate the promise at the time the promise is made. It's the promisor's state of mind that is the issue where a fraud can negate a subsequent contract. So again,
so you can make a promise, and if before they accept it, you know you're not going to give them what you said you were, you just stay silent, and then when they accept it, it's just too bad. Because at the beginning, I really believed it.
The case law reflects back on when the promise is made. So when that promise is thrown out to the world, the state of mind of the promiser is evaluated at that point in time. Elliot Whitfield wrote this letter on October 24th of 2011. On that date, there is no contention, no evidence, no argument that he had any fraudulent intent when he made that promise.
I'm with you there, but those people couldn't accept that promise until there was a change in ownership.
There's no case law that says the promise is evaluated at some subsequent time based on acceptance of a unilateral contract or what have you. It's simply what is the state of mind of the promiser when he made the promise. On December 7th, when that closing occurred, what followed after the closing was the new operators came in, took over the stores, the employees became employees of the new operators, and life went on. I mean, there was no evidence that there was any kind of conference to decide whether or not to tell these 10 employees, as opposed to the rest of the employees who were paid bonuses. There's no evidence that there was any kind of discussion or consideration of whether or not these 10 should have been singled out on that date and advised. In fact, what happened was the new operators came in and took over. Part of the fraud
were
case
these
law.
Employees handed contracts with the new operators and said, here, you have to sign this. You've got to go work for Sunoco. You've got to work for SSK Petro.
There was a letter after the fact that was circulated, and the employees were requested to sign, and 9 out of the 10 signed, which confirmed that they had accepted employment with the new operators. By the time that letter was circulated, it was after the fact. It was February 20th, if I remember correctly. Most of them were dated.
So you don't think do those letters have anything to do with the claim or the failure of the claim? That it just verifies what had already happened, that they went to work for some different companies?
Yeah, the letters were so late, I don't think they reflect on, and they certainly don't reflect on the intent of Elliot Whitfield back on October 24th. And I don't believe they necessarily, there was no evidence that linked them to the state of mind of the new shareholder, Dr. Coley, on December 7th. They simply occurred late in the record. February 20th, they confirm events that already occurred. They appear to be a cover your acts kind of letter that was thought of after the fact and solidify our position by having these people sign this letter.
But it's interesting because I guess at that point in time, and I assume all these entities must be somehow related, they're working for different entities, but they were told if they didn't sign that document, they'd be terminated. I mean, so if the guy who wants them to sign the letter is no longer their employer, how in the world could that have happened?
Well, there's the entities that purchased the convenience store operations shared no ownership with the Dr. Coley, the shareholder who purchased, was the principal of Modern Fuel, which purchased the stock of Modern Oil. They have no shared ownership. However, they do have ongoing contractual relations. Modern Oil had contracted with these operators to provide fuel to the convenience stores that they were running. So they still had business relations.
Dealership agreements.
But there was no common ownership. There was no common management.
Is there any allegation of agency or any sort of theory of vicarious liability asserted in this case?
I don't believe so. None at all. And during the jury instructions phase, the claim of constructive fraud was taken off the table. No instructions were asked for constructive fraud. This is just simply an actual fraud case.
What happened to the breach of contract claim, count one?
The breach of contract wasn't decided because the jury went with fraud, and I believe it was presented into them as an alternative. You can have one or the other, because if there was a fraud, then there's no contract. On the breach of contract claim, I believe based on the stipulation that they were offered and accepted employment within the 90 days, if you look back at the letter, you would get a bonus if you were still employed after 90 days after closing, or if you were terminated with cause during the 90 days, but not if you were terminated. The letter doesn't say this, but the the remainder of it would be, you wouldn't be entitled to a bonus if you were terminated with cause. That's not really an issue here. Or you wouldn't be entitled to a bonus if you had left the company to accept employment with someone else. The stipulation at trial was they were offered and accepted employment. We would ask,
did they know that if they didn't accept that employment, they'd get a month's severance, basically?
Well, as I understand from your prior question, the implication was if they didn't accept the employment, they'd be terminated. If they were terminated and there wasn't a cause for it, they would certainly be entitled to the bonus.
Mm-hmm.
But by accepting employment with the new operators, they disqualified themselves from the bonus. The heart of this appeal comes down to, there may be, on this contract issue, were they offered and accepted employment with someone else? Were they constructively terminated without cause? That wasn't ever decided by the court or the jury. That issue is a contract issue. This case should have been a contract case. That's the issue the court and the jury should have decided. But instead it was decided on fraud without evidence to support the fraud.
When you say should have decided, the jury verdict didn't rule one way or the other on contract, right?
Right.
So if you were to win your challenge to the fraud count, would you object to a remand for a jury trial on contract? Sorry.
But actually, what we asked for is either enter judgment for Modern Oil on the contract or remanded for a trial on the contract issue.
Well, we would not enter judgment in all likelihood on a disputed factual case on appeal, but there is no cross error assigned to the absence of a finding in favor of the plaintiff on the contract claim, but you're willing to concede the point, I take it.
Yes.
Okay.
And I would reserve my 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Vinson, and I represent the Appalachian Barber Candidate et al. I principally don't have much disagreement with the appellant's characterization of the facts, but I think relevant to the court's decision today, several facts were omitted in his summation. Namely, that never at any point, and this came through the testimony of Barbara Kennedy and Erica Evans, which was later stipulated to be applicable to all 10 plaintiffs, that they were never told at any point that the individuals that were running their respective convenience stores were anyone other than the corporation that bought S.W. Rawls. And in fact, steps were taken actively at that time by these third-party corporations to conceal that fact. Ms. Kennedy testified specifically in reference to how these employees were paid. She testified essentially that when the hours were calculated, she was instructed to endorse checks from another company that were to be placed in that day's deposits, and the individuals were to be paid cash out of the register. They didn't receive any checks, and they didn't receive any pay stubs. Nothing to indicate who was actually paying them.
May I interrupt you for a minute with the same question I asked earlier? The complaint is an actual fraud complaint. It's an active misrepresentation. It's not a non-disclosure complaint. Every action paragraph refers back to the October 24 letter. Given the stipulation at trial that there was no actual fraud in that letter, and the stipulation we just heard that even in the absence of a cross error or cross appeal, the matter could be remanded for contract determination, is that not a reasonable result for your client?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so under the circumstances as the case is postured before Your Honors this morning. That is an error that wasn't assigned in the appellant's petition or even addressed in their brief at all.
Their statement of the case is that they moved to strike on two grounds, the absence of pleadings outside of the letter and the absence of fraud outside of the letter.
And, Your Honor, I don't specifically recall that instance from the trial. I'll be honest with you. But, again, be that as it may, it wasn't assigned as an error to be determined by your honors this morning.
How would he assign error to the trial court erred in, or the jury erred in not finding my client guilty of breach of contract? Isn't that what he would have to, what would he assign error to?
Specifically, the motion to strike on the basis that the pleadings weren't sufficient.
But he did assign error to the motion to strike.
My reading, Your Honors, of the appellant's assignment of error as to the motion to strike.
He's assigned error to the motion to strike, to the instruction, to the verdict notwithstanding. It seemed to me he assigned error all along the way to this is not a fraud claim.
Well, Your Honor, my statement in the regard to not being assigned to an error was specifically in reference to the pleadings being insufficient. And the assignment of error as to the motion to strike only addressed two points, the first being where there was no evidence of any intent not to perform a promise to pay bonuses when the promise was made, and because no post-promise independent tort duty to clarify the promise previously made exists under Virginia law. So I guess my statement in that regard is specifically that no error was assigned, that the pleadings weren't sufficient to establish a claim under the evidence that was presented.
Is the jury verdict form in the JA? I can't find it. Is it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you. You make a little bit of the argument. I'll continue.
I think at least it's the appellee's position that the issue that's before the court today, and I believe it was acknowledged by Justice Goodwin, I think can be reduced to a fundamental disagreement as to the characterization of Mr. Whitfield's letter. The appellant posits this as a contract or as a promise, and we certainly don't dispute that. But it's our position that it's a very particular type of contract. A unilateral contract that can only be accepted upon at least the beginning to perform the tasks that the offer requests. And in the case at bar, it creates approximately a six-week gap between when the letter was sent and presumably delivered and when the actual acceptance happens when the contract comes into existence. Now, all of the case law that has been cited, and to my belief, certainly in our brief, and I believe in the appellant's brief, references fraud and the inducement, actual fraud claims that are specifically relating to traditional bilateral contracts that when they form, both sides have the ability to create a legal action or begin a legal action for breach of that contract. That's not what we have here today. Now, what...
Well, if what you're saying is true, then that would mean that the law of fraud would say this, that you have a duty to tell someone that you don't intend to do what you earlier said you were going to do, but at the time you said that, you actually did intend it. That's just a... If I characterize it right, that sounds like an anomalous holding for a court to interpret common law fraud that way.
Well, Your Honor, it would be our position that it wasn't just we didn't tell them that we had no intention to make good on Mr. Whitfield's letter. That certainly didn't happen. And that's important to our case here. But I think specifically with considering the letters, the blank form letters, which I believe are in the appendix on page 253, the testimony of Ms. Canaday and Ms. Evans was that those letters were presented to them by their bosses, who they only knew by first name, who at the time...
Do you mean the dealers for those stations, the new dealers?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not the defendant?
Correct. And, but we have two separate third-party corporations, two separate dealers, Sunoco, Mart, I believe, and SSK Petro. Now, there's a contractual relationship between the defendant and those third-party corporations, namely the leases on the convenience stores and gas stations, as well as the petroleum sales agreements. Now, through the petroleum sales agreement, the appellant, Modern Oil, has a vested interest in these particular entities being able to function and operate and sell petroleum products supplied by the defendant. Now, it's curious that two separate third-party corporations would have the exact same letter addressed to Dr. Coley, who is a majority shareholder of the Shell Corporation that owns Modern Oil, or through that, the majority shareholder of Modern Oil, addressed to him indicating that they were not terminated. They accepted employment through these other corporations, and I think as the appellant's counsel characterizes, to cover themselves. It's curious how two separate third-party corporations would produce the same letter addressed to the same person for the same purpose if there wasn't some sort of agency agreement or some sort of agency relationship that was established between the two. And I think just the nature of the letter and how it was delivered and the fact that the appellees testified that they were told if they don't sign it, they're fired. I think that's circumstantial evidence of an agency relationship between the two, or the three parties, actually. That tied with the manner in which they were paid out of the register, I think that that is evidence of affirmative actions being taken to make this concealment.
But this conspiracy theory, whether it's factually true or not, is just miles away from this complaint and pretty far away from the arguments at the motion to strike stage. Is this something that you're saying we should look to as a possible hypothesis to affirm on that ground?
Well, Your Honor, in reference to the arguments that were made at motion to strike, all of that being said, the main focus, the main crux of the appellant's claim still is the fact that Modern Oil had knowledge of their expectations in this contract. They presumably, as far as they were aware, accepted it, and Modern Oil knew what those expectations were and concealed fact that, hey, we're not going to make good on this particular offer.
But that's an important point. Non-disclosure is not ipso facto concealment. Non-disclosure is, I'm not saying anything, concealment is doing something, however slight.
Well,
did the misrepresentation occur?
Ma'am?
When exactly did the Modern Oil misrepresentation occur?
I mean, it would be our position that up until the point that the stock sale agreement closed, Modern Fuels is this Shell corporation that was entering into all of these secondary agreements, the leases and the petroleum sales agreements with the third-party dealers. So it's our position that the misrepresentation occurred as the appellees acted in accordance with this letter, i.e. they continued working at their respective convenience stores at the time subsequent to the stock sale close. Now,
let me ask this. I thought your theory of the case, in essence, was that this letter goes out from Whitfield. What's the fellow's name who bought him?
Dr. Coley.
Dr. Coley is disclosed, this agreement is disclosed to him before he buys the company. He buys the company knowing that he's not going to keep these businesses where these people are working at. They can't accept the offer until after he buys the company. So he's the corporation. And it's really his mindset when he let that offer stay out there and these people accepted it by their actions the day after he bought the company. And then after that, all these other things are indicia of concealment a misrepresentation that he knew was being made.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would look to the Van Dusen v. Sneed case, which specifically discusses the particular form of actual fraud that is the basis of our claim, fraud and the inducement, when the Supreme Court of Virginia stated a contracting party's willful nondisclosure of a material fact that he knows is unknown to the other party may evince an intent to practice actual fraud. And the case continues, if a party conceals a fact that is material to a transaction, knowing that the other party is acting on the assumption that no such fact exists, the concealment is as much a fraud as if the existence of the fact were expressly denied or the reverse of it expressly stated.
When you say the doctor purchased the company, you mean purchased the majority shareholder interest in the company, right?
Well, Your Honor, the doctor, and I believe his testimony was that he was a 60% shareholder of Modern Fuels.
Well, the defendant here, of course, is Modern Oil, which is the successor of Rawls.
Correct, Your Honor. And Modern Fuels bought 100% of Modern Oil.
So he's 60% of a holding company that bought the stock of Rawls.
Yes, Your Honor.
And changed the name of Rawls to Modern Oil.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's not Modern Oil. He is a shareholder.
He is a shareholder, and I believe he's the president of Modern Oil.
After the purchase.
After the purchase, yes, Your Honor.
But the letter was sent out by the Rawls president before the purchase.
That is correct. That's why I think that, though it appears a little bit confusing, but I think that that's why the point in time when the employees or the appellees accepted this unilateral contract is so clear. Now, these people came in the day of the closing sale, and they essentially said, hey, we're your boss, and this is what we're going to do. And it's at that point where it would be our position that the concealment took place. And the appellees respectfully request that this honorable court affirm the September 17th judgment order of the Circuit Court of South Lincoln County.
Was it some condition or a term of the Rawls to Modern Oil transaction that Rawls takes steps to preserve continuity of the employees?
Whether it was a term of the actual sales contract, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
I'm just wondering the big picture here. Did Mr. Whitfield do this out of the kindness of his heart because he liked his employees and wanted to assure them, you know, not to be upset by the change in ownership, that they were going to still have a job? Or was it as part of the terms of the sale, that he would provide continuity of the employees?
I believe it was his testimony that it was part of the terms of the sale, and I think that's indicated in the letter that he actually sent, that they were, I believe it was that they were an out-of-town corporation who they didn't have any interest in a turnover in the labor force, and they were seeking continuity, and I think that's evidenced in his letter, but I can't specifically point to a provision in the actual stock sale agreement that outlines that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Counsel referred to the Van Dusen case, and the Van Dusen case involves a homeowner selling his house, and he actively takes steps to superficially patch over a crack that's in the foundation of the house, and he sells the house, and he gets a resulting fraud claim against him, and the court affirms that, yes, that's fraud. And again, that fits in with the basic elements of actual fraud, which two of which are that you intentionally and knowingly make a misrepresentation, and then also that you have an intent to deceive. And again, in the Van Dusen case, you can see, covering the crack, there's an affirmative act that indicates this concealment. But in the instant case, in the Modern Oil case, all you have is counsel reference how these people were paid by the subsequent operators. Again, that's the subsequent operator. And there's no allegation of an agency or an apparent agency in the complaint, and there was no evidence of any agency at the trial. These were just simply interactions between the new operators and their employees, and they reflect nothing back on the officers or the principals of Modern Oil Corporation.
The fact that they just happen to be paid cash out of the register instead of receiving checks.
There is no
indication. From a new entity.
I'm sorry, Judge.
No.
There was no evidence, no indication that the method of their payment had anything to do with Modern Oil Corporation. The new operators, there was testimony that the new operators did come in. All the contracts selling the convenience store operations and establishing the supply of gasoline to them by Modern Oil, all these were in evidence at trial. The evidence indicated that on the closing date, Modern Oil sold and conveyed the convenience store operations to new operators who then came in and dealt with the employees. There's no evidence that what the new operators did with respect to their payroll or hours people worked or whatever was done by or on behalf of Modern Oil anytime after closing. There were new operators. They had new rights. They had contractual basis for their actions. And they don't reflect back on Modern Oil or Dr. Coley after the December 7th closing. So there's no affirmative action. There's no evidence of any affirmative steps or even that Dr. Coley considered the issue on December 7th or later.
Before the closing, was Dr. Coley ever an agent, an officer, or a shareholder of the Rawls Company?
No.
But clearly there's successive corporate liability because all the shares of Rawls were sold to this new entity, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And that would be all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.